to talk about today was done in collaboration with a student at Princeton. His name is Aras Aten Dhrudanada, and he's a top manager at 10 syllables, and then Professor Andre Bernadette at Princeton. So since there's a lot of young people here, I'm going to sort of go through some background information on topological insulators and quantum entanglement for free fermion systems. And then toward the last third of my talk, I'm going to actually discuss the sort of new results we have. So the first part, I'm going to focus on 2 plus 1D topological insulators, both time reversal breaking and time reversal invariant topological insulators, which are called the quantum Hall effect and the quantum spin Hall effect, respectively. The sort of middle part of my talk, I'm going to discuss single particle and many particle entanglement spectra for these systems and for other insulating systems, but basically free fermion systems. And the last part, I'm going to talk about a new topological invariant derived from the entanglement spectrum and its connection to the sort of well-known topological invariants. So let's begin with the definition. So what is a topological insulator? It's an insulator, so the bulk of the material is completely gapped. That means you have no low energy excitations. What's interesting about these systems is that on the boundaries, actually, not in the center, but on the boundaries, there are actually gapless low energy states. And these are fermionic modes on the surfaces or edges that are protected from things like disorder and very robust to perturbations. And the sort of names you see along with these types of fermions are chiral fermions, Dirac fermions, Majorana fermions, and chiral Majorana. And what's special about these types of fermions is they're holographic. So what that means is that the sort of states that occur on the boundary of these systems can only occur on the boundary of a higher dimensional system. They can't occur intrinsically in their sort of surface dimension. So for example, on the edge of a quantum Hall effect, you have a chiral fermion edge state on the 1 plus 1 dimensional boundary, and you can never write down a 1D chiral fermion theory intrinsically in 1D. It always has to come from the boundary of a higher dimensional system. So interestingly, these sort of states of matter are characterized by a non-zero topological invariant. This is an intrinsic number, which is topological in nature, which means if you deform your system continuously, this number never changes. And so it's some state of matter characterized by a number. And what's been sort of found recently is that in order to be stable phases of matter, they may require you preserve some extra symmetry in the system. So for example, like a time reversal symmetry or some kind of particle hole symmetry. And the common examples that people have been talking about the last, say, 20 years, and especially the last 5 years, are the integer quantum Hall effect, the quantum anomalous Hall effect, which is a quantum Hall effect that arises from some intrinsic magnetization, the quantum spin Hall effect, and the 3D strong topological insulator. The last two are the sort of recent examples, which are time reversal invariant. So I'm going to focus on the two in red, which are the quantum anomalous Hall effect and quantum spin Hall, which are both realized in two dimensions. So to sort of show you the big picture of where these topological insulators fit in, this is the sort of periodic table of topological insulators. And what this table shows is that in the every sort of different row represents a different space-time dimension, so 0 plus 1D, 1 plus 1, 2 plus 1, and so on, all the way down to infinite dimension. And each column represents a different type of symmetry that needs to be protected. Okay, so the class A2 here is the class that requires a fermionic time reversal symmetry, so time reversal like spin 1/2. And the one I'm going to focus on is this red one I've enclosed here in 2 plus 1D, which is classified by some Z2 quantity. So there's an intrinsic quantity, which is either odd or even, which distinguishes these states from sort of trivial states of matter. And the other one I'm going to focus on is this A class, which is the class that doesn't require any symmetry. And this is the case, this is the place where quantum Hall exists, and this is classified by some integer. And what's nice about this table is that periodic is not just sort of a label to make you think about elements. It's actually, this table is periodic. So it's actually periodic both in the vertical direction and in the horizontal direction. And so every 8 dimensions, this sort of table repeats. Every 2 dimensions, this sort of split off table repeats. And this is due to some deep mathematical results called Bott periodicity. So all this sort of families of topological insulators fit into some nice mathematical framework. And the two I'm going to focus on today are the ones that are enclosed there in the boxes. So what's nice is that this is sort of not just theory. We actually have real examples of these materials. So there's this integer quantum Hall sample, which is on some chip. You also have this quantum spin Hall. These are the sort of paradigm smoking gun experiments, which have illustrated these. I'm not going to discuss the experiments, but here's excerpts from sort of real data to show these things have been measured in nature and the sort of relevant physical phenomena have been shown. But let's sort of go over some characteristics. So the integer quantum Hall state is gapped in the bulk. It's described by some integer topological invariant, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Its gapless boundary states are chiral fermions, and all chiral fermion means is that in 1D, it's a fermion that can only travel in one direction. Okay, so a chiral fermion, you should take to mean a chiral fermion is a fermion that can only go one way, either forward or backward. Okay, and the symmetry class is called the unitary class, and it's a class that requires no special symmetries to be stable.
The quantum spin Hall effect is another 2 plus 1D topological insulator. The bulk is gapped again, and it's described by a Z2 topological invariance, either plus or minus, or 1 or minus 1. And on the boundary of this system, you actually have chiral and anti-chiral states. So on each edge of the quantum spin Hall effect, you have states going both directions. You have one going right and one going left. And this class actually does require a symmetry. It requires time reversal symmetry. So this state of matter is completely destroyed if you apply a magnetic field. So if you break time reversal symmetry by applying some field, you can sort of destroy that state, whereas the integer quantum Hall, you cannot. So the sort of minimal model for this topological insulator in 2 plus 1D is this 2 plus 1D massive Dirac equation. So this is some 2 by 2 matrix. It has linear dispersion, and this is a Dirac equation in 2D. And the sort of example is this two-dimensional sheet, which has this edge state, which only circulates in one direction. The quantum spin Hall effect is easy to understand. It's just two copies of the quantum Hall effect, one for spin up and one for spin down. And you sort of imagine, I've sort of drawn these things separated, but these are sort of in the same layer. So you imagine that the quantum Hall effect is made up of two copies of, the quantum spin Hall effect is made up of two copies of quantum Hall, one for spin up and one for spin down, and the spin up and spin down edge states circulate in opposite directions, so it preserves time reversal symmetry. So if you act with time reversal on this system, the direction of motion of the edge state reverses, but so does the spin, and so this one just gets mapped to that one and vice versa, so the system's invariant under time reversal. But this is a cartoon picture. You should imagine these things are in the same layer. They're not bilayers. Okay. So we typically understand that an insulator from sort of thinking about insulators in electronics. So if you have an insulator, what it means is if you attach wires to it, it doesn't conduct electricity. So if you take glass or wood or something and attach wires to it, nothing actually happens. So I'm going to show you how this differs in topological insulators. I'm going to do this by sort of just at least initially illustrating how these systems respond to electromagnetic fields. So to show you the formalism, to show the formalism how I'm going to do this, I'm going to give an example of the Ising model just so you can understand what I'm calculating. So this is an example of the Ising model, which you've seen in undergraduate statistical mechanics, which is sort of two spins or spins on a one-dimensional lattice, and the spins are coupled in the z direction, nearest neighbors. And I'm applying some external magnetic fields. The magnetic field is not fluctuating, it's some classical field that I'm applying with a solenoid in my lab. So from this, if you want to see how the system responds to the external field, you calculate the partition function by summing over all spin configurations. And that leaves you with a partition function which depends on the B field. And you define this to be some free energy, e to the minus beta, which is 1 over temperature, times some function of the magnetic field. If you want to see how the system responds to the magnetic field, all you do is simply calculate the free energy and take a derivative of the free energy with respect to the magnetic field to get the magnetization. So this tells you that the system has a magnetization in response to your external field. So we're going to do the exact same thing, except we're going to do it for a field theory. And so what we have is we have a Lagrangian for our Dirac fermions with a mass. So this is sort of the Lagrangian of these fermions I showed you a minute ago. And I think let's try this again. And so this is a functional or a function of my external electromagnetic field, A mu. So now what I do is I sum over all fermion configurations. So I do this path integral. And I'm defining this to be e to the I times some effective action, which is like my free energy functional. And to find the response, all you do is take the log and then take a derivative. And this response in this case is the electromagnetic current as a response to an external field. Okay, so it's exactly the same as doing the Ising model case, but the calculation is a little bit more involved. All right. So what you find is that if you do this for this quantum Hall state, so you actually calculate this diagram, you find the effective action has the Maxwell action plus this extra term. So I've only written down the extra term here. This is a topological term called the Chern-Simons term, but it's very simple. It has some coefficient here, and this coefficient value n is actually an integer, which represents this integer topological invariant. And if you calculate the response by taking the equations of motion of this action, you simply find there's a current proportional to the electric field and a charge proportional to the magnetic field. So, for example, if you apply an electric field, you get some current perpendicular to that because you have this epsilon tensor, which is the Hall effect. And if you have a magnetic flux line in your system, this binds charge to it. Okay, so whenever you have flux, magnetic field, you get charge density. So if I apply an electric field to this special type of insulator, I get a current in the insulator, which actually travels perpendicular to the electric field. And if you apply a magnetic field, you get charge. If this was a trivial insulator, or the insulators you're familiar with, the sort of coefficient n would be zero, and the current you would get would be zero. So if you apply an electric field to an insulator, it just polarizes. There's no currents at all. Okay. Or if you apply a magnetic field, it may magnetize, but you don't get charge bound to it. Okay. So these special type of insulators, you can measure some physical properties which distinguish them from, say, glass or some other silicon or something which has an insulating gap. Okay, so let's try to understand this picture a little bit better about the physical response. So we're going to need this physics for the part when I talk about entanglement. So let's sort of go over some experiment I'm going to do by applying some electric field in a special way to my quantum Hall system. So imagine I wrap my quantum Hall system in a cylinder. So now I have these two boundaries. And the sort of band structure or energy spectrum looks like this. I have some valence band, which I've sort of, as I have a block here, which are all filled states. I have some conduction band, which are all empty. And in the middle, you have these states which lie on the edge. So these red states lie on one edge, and you see the group velocity only goes in one direction. And the blue states lie on the other edge. These are physically, spatially separated, and their group velocity goes in the other direction. So these edge state dispersions represent chiral fermions, because a single branch and a single edge only goes in one direction. So now I'm going to apply an electric field, but I'm going to do that through the Faraday effect. So I'm going to turn on some magnetic flux, which is going to penetrate this sort of hollow cylinder. And from the Faraday effect, this time-changing flux gives me a circulating electric field. So as soon as I turn on flux as a function of time, I get an electric field which is circulating around the system, and I should expect some current to move perpendicular to that circulating electric field because I have a quantum Hall effect. Okay, so we can simply test this. So what we do is we see that as a, we can sort of integrate the sort of change, what we're after is sort of the change in the vector potential per unit time, and I'll tell you this in a minute. And so what we do is you integrate this equation over the time you thread a single flux quantum. So we're imagining we have this hollow cylinder, we're turning on a magnetic field very slowly as a function of time, and after a time, big T, we're going to have one flux quantum in there. So while the flux is changing, we're generating some electric field, and this is causing a current. So what happens is that as you thread this flux as a function of time, the vector potential changes by some amount, H over E, divided by the length in the circular direction. And because of minimal coupling, this means that P, the momentum of the system, gets shifted by P plus EA. And so in fact, P actually gets shifted by one quantized amount. And so as you thread one flux quantum, what happens is that each of these edge states, the modes shift by one unit. So for example, the red mode clicks up one unit to the right, and the blue mode also clicks up one unit to the right, but its group velocity is opposite. So at the end of threading one flux quantum, what you find is that in the red branch, you have an extra state. In the blue branch, you have a missing state. And since these states exist on opposite edges, what this implies is that you've transferred one charge from one edge to the other edge. And so this is exactly the quantum Hall effect. You thread one flux quantum, you get charge moving from one side to the other side. And so all that's happening is you're turning on some electric field, which is driving a current. And you're stopping the electric field after a certain amount of time. Okay, so that's sort of the review on topological insulators that we're going to need. Now I'm going to move on to discuss single particle and many particle entanglement of free fermion systems. So probably not many of you people are familiar with this type of entanglements. I'm going to go through this very slowly, so hopefully you can learn something about how this is calculated. It's not very difficult. Okay, so in the last few years, entanglements become sort of a hot topic in condensed matter. And the reason is the following. In condensed matter, we have this sort of underlying goal that given some many-body quantum ground state, you want to be able to figure out what the state of matter is from that ground state alone. So, many-body physics and condensed matter physics in general is all about ground states, figuring out what types of states of matter and what type of vacua you can see in nature. And so the sort of goal is that if given any many-body ground state, I can tell you what state of matter it's in. Okay? This is very easy to do, for example, if your state has a broken symmetry. So if your state's a magnet, all you do is take the expectation value of your state with some operator, M, that represents the magnetization. And so you can do this with any type of local operator, and if it's non-zero, you sort of picked out what symmetry is broken, and that tells you a hint about what the state of matter is. Okay? But suppose you can take any local operator you want, and every value you calculate gives you zero. Okay? So if the system is featureless, which means it has no features which stand out, no symmetry broken features, we can ask, are all featureless systems the same? So if every single local operator you calculate in this expectation value vanishes, are all those systems identical, or is there something else which can distinguish them? So the answer to this question is no, they're not all identical. And so it's known that quantum systems can exhibit a topological order or some kind of topological properties which can globally distinguish them even though they cannot be locally distinguished. So for example, you see no small local magnetization, you see no local charge density array, but you can see some sort of global feature. And so what's nice is that entanglement is very, very useful in distinguishing these sort of subtle long distance correlations. So entanglement tells you about how parts of the system, long distances, are connected with each other and correlated. And so it's very useful sort of characterizing these sort of topological features. Okay? There's also a hope for a practical advantage having to do with entanglement, and that's that there's the potential to learn a lot about a many-body interacting system from the ground state alone. So if you want to calculate the entanglement, which I'll tell you about in a minute, you actually only need the ground state. And so if you can learn a lot about the system without having to calculate the full many-body spectrum, that's very helpful because it's very, very difficult to calculate interacting systems numerically. So if you know a ground state, hopefully you can learn a lot about the entire system and its excitations in some ways from looking at how the system's correlated over long distances via entanglement, because you don't want to calculate the entire many-body spectrum. So there are many types of entanglement. I'm going to focus on partitions of entanglement in real space. So I imagine that I have some spatial region like this, like a torus or a cylinder, and I'm going to cut my system into two pieces. So the typical procedure is that you give some many-body ground state psi, and you construct the density matrix from this state psi. So I construct the density matrix like you would do in normal quantum mechanics. And then I partition my system into two regions. So you can partition it any way you want in Hilbert space. You can partition momentum space, a mixture of momentum in real space, but I'm only going to do real space. And once you do this partitioning, what you do is you can write your many-body wave function as a sum over linear combinations of these basis states which exist in region A and region B, and then with some coefficients labeled by this exponential here, which depend on the basis state, and then you trace out B. Okay, so what you're doing is you're sort of tracing out or measuring region B and leaving behind some density matrix which only has information about region A. Okay. So what you want to calculate from this full density matrix is what's called the reduced density matrix, rho A. This is given by tracing out the sort of other partition B. And once you have rho of A for any many-body ground state or for any ground state in general, you can calculate your favorite entanglement measures. And this sort of, there's many entanglement measures to look at. Yeah?
Why are these coefficients all real? Or they don't have to be all real?
They don't have to be all real.
So psi can be complex.
Yes, that can be complex. That's right. Yeah. Yes, that can be complex. But I think, I mean, the entanglement spectrum is going to be all real because it's actually a density matrix combination, not just the state itself. So there's some phase cancellation, I think. So the sort of three most popular measures of entanglement, I would say, at least in standard condensed matter physics, are one, the entanglement spectrum, which is just looking at the entire set of eigenvalues of this density operator rho A. There's also the standard entanglement entropy or von Neumann entropy, which is this combination. So it's taking the entire entanglement spectrum and calculating this number S, which is this rho trace of rho A log rho A. There's also the Rényi entropies, which are moments, or sort of like moments of the entanglement spectrum, which are entropies indexed by some continuous number alpha, which are, yeah, continuous, or you could keep discrete, but in this case, alpha can be any parameter you want. And so this is sort of gives you extra information about the full entanglement spectrum. Okay, so now I'm gonna show you how to calculate entanglement in free fermion systems. So what we're gonna do here is we're gonna calculate what's called the single particle entanglement spectrum. So since we have free fermions, it's non-interacting. And so it turns out there's a nice simplification because the system is non-interacting. And so you can calculate the single particle entanglement spectrum using what's called Peschel's method. So given some lattice Hamiltonian, so this is my lattice Hamiltonian where these C's are indexed by sites N. What we want to calculate is this two-particle correlation function. So this correlation function here is an expectation value of the operator C dagger M on a site M and CN on site N in the many-body ground state. So once we calculate this, we can define what's called an entanglement Hamiltonian, which is the log of this operator quantity here, where C, in this case, is this operator restricted to lie in region A. So what we do is we take this, we calculate this matrix, which depends on the sites. We restrict the sites to lie in the region we want to consider, which is region A. So we reduce the matrix in this way. And we can calculate these entanglement energies, which we'll talk about in a minute, the entanglement spectrum, by looking at the eigenvalues of this operator, the log of this quantity. So the sort of goal is you diagonalize this Hamiltonian, you calculate this matrix, you restrict the matrix, and then from that you get the eigenvalues. Okay. So it turns out this method is much more efficient than calculating the many-body reduced density matrix, for which you'd have to take the full Slater determinant ground state. So we'll see in a minute how to construct the many-body density matrix eigenvalues from the single-body case, but you don't want to be dealing with any type of many-body ground state if you don't have to. And since it's free fermions, in this case you don't have to. So I'm going to give you an example of how this is calculated now. So suppose I have six sites which are connected periodically. So this last site is connected to the first site. So this Hamiltonian can be represented by a 6x6 matrix, which is just this matrix. Okay? So this matrix is easy to diagonalize. We find six energy states, which sort of lie on this curve, which is the curve minus 2t cosine of q. So we have these six states. Okay, we had a 6x6 matrix. It's got six eigenstates.
And the six energies here correspond to six wave functions. These wave functions are nothing but plane waves because you have a translation invariant lattice system in this case, right? So the wave function is e to the I qx, and a q takes values from 0 to 5, which index these energies here. So to give you some intuition, suppose that our fermion ground state consists of only one occupied state. Okay, so this is the trivialest, most trivial case you can get, besides having no occupied states. So assume that the only state we have occupied in our ground state is this lowest energy state at q equals 0. So we're going to calculate the entanglement of this system, this free fermion system with one occupied fermion in the lowest energy state. So to do this, we're going to calculate this matrix. And since we only have one occupied state, this matrix is trivial to calculate. And it's simply psi star of q equals 0, psi q with indices m and n. And if you work out what this matrix is, it's this trivial matrix, 1/6 times all 1s. Okay. So we see, in fact, that you know these rows are not all linearly independent. So in fact, this matrix has only one independent eigenvalue. Okay. So if you actually diagonalize this matrix as it is, you'll get 5 0 eigenvalues and one eigenvalue of eigenvalue 1. Okay. But what we're going to try to do now is calculate the entanglement. So what we want to do is to partition this matrix into pieces. So suppose I want to look at the entanglement of one site with the rest of the system. And what you do in this case is you sort of just extract the first element. And that's the eigenvalue of a 1x1 matrix is just the element, so it's just 1/6. Okay? So now suppose I want to cut, so I look at the first three sites entangled with the rest. So then what I would do is I would diagonalize this matrix, okay, in this case. All right? So again, you're only going to get one non-zero eigenvalue. And if you want to look at further states, you can partition it however you want. Okay? What we see, so this is a plot. I guess it looks kind of funny here. So what we see is that the red lines here are the red dots are the eigenvalues of this matrix, the eigenvalues of the C matrix, as a function of states I'm partitioning. So this is partitioning with zero sites in region A, one site, two sites, and so on. Okay? And this blue curve is the entanglement entropy as a function of what I'm partitioning in this case. All right? So for the entanglement, entanglement eigenvalues of 0 and 1 give no entanglement entropy. And so the only values that give you some finite entanglement entropy are when the values are between 0 and 1. And what we see is that for this trivial system we're looking at here, the entanglement spectrum is nothing but the probability of each state, the probability of this wave function to lie in region A. Okay? So if you count, if you look at what these numbers are as a function of the length you're partitioning, this just increases by the amount of probability of that wave function in each region. So you can think about the entanglement spectrum intuitively in some sense, is it counts the probabilities that each of these states lies in region A. Okay? It's more complicated than that if you have more than one state in your ground state, but for one state, it simply tells you what the probability lies in region A. So for example, if you have some localized states, if your state sits only on this one site, then as soon as you've partitioned around the system, this state only contributes a 1 to the entanglement spectrum, and thus contributes no entanglement entropy. Okay? So only states which have weight in both sides, both partitions, A and B, give you any kind of entanglement entropy. If it's completely localized, you don't get any entanglement entropy coming from this state because it gives an eigenvalue of 1, which doesn't contribute to the entanglement entropy. Okay. So now that I've given this free Fermion example, I'm going to move on in a minute to talking about how topological insulators in entanglement. Yes?
So how does it depend on the gradient index alpha then, which weights the smaller eigenvalues more?
So in this case, it's just a function. I mean, so this is the most trivial case. So I take a fermion system, I'm only taking one occupied state. So I'm looking at the entanglement of one state, you know, that's it. And so the gradient entropy is only a function of the probability in this case. And so depending on the distribution of the weight of this state, the gradient entropies may be able to help you reconstruct what the wave function maybe looked like or something like this. But I don't know off the top of my head how the functional form will look. But I would imagine that as a function of alpha, you would see very different behavior, for example, between localized and delocalized states. So maybe it'd help you look at certain systems or something. Okay, so I'm going to go over some basic connections between topological insulators and entanglement to sort of unravel some possible confusion. So first question is, are topological insulators topologically ordered? And the answer is no. So they have non-degenerate ground states. They're free fermion systems. And so they have, on any manifold, unlike topological order systems, they have a unique ground state. Okay, so they're not topologically ordered. That immediately means that there's no topological contribution to the entanglement entropy. Okay, so beyond the area law, there's often corrections to the area law. Constant universal correction is called the topological entanglement entropy, and for all topological insulators, this number vanishes. Okay,
So without topological entanglement entropy, we can ask, are there any interesting properties? Okay, and the answer is yes. And so they exhibit non-trivial forms of fermion entanglement, which we're going to see in the rest of the talk. And the other thing is that the other connection between topological insulators and entanglement is that topological insulators can never be deformed adiabatically to have vanishing entanglement entropy. So no matter what cut you take, you can never deform a topological insulator Hamiltonian to having vanishing entanglement entropy unless you close a gap somewhere. Okay? This is not true for a trivial insulator, which you can adiabatically connect to an atomic limit where all the hoppings are turned off. And the atomic limit, of course, will always have vanishing entanglement entropy because the states are completely localized. Okay. So in contrast, Alyosha and some collaborators and I did some work on the quantum double models or string net models and torque codes. So these are examples which are only topological. Okay. That means they don't have any fermionic or low energy states in the entanglement. They only have the topological piece. Okay. So there's sort of these two separate pictures of systems which have no topological entanglement entropy, but have this fermion entanglement, which I'll go over in a minute, and systems which have purely topological entanglement entropy and have no low energy entanglement spectrum. Okay, the entanglement spectrum are featureless. So there are two well-known examples which have both of these combined. So one is the Kataev-Honeycomb model, which has both. In fact, the fermion and gauge theory part are completely decoupled from each other. The other case is the fractional quantum Hall effect, which has both a low energy entanglement spectrum coming from edge, sort of edge physics, and a topological piece coming from the topological order. So the topological insulators sort of capture half of the interesting entanglement. They get the fermionic part, the interesting edge theory part. Okay. So, like I said, they don't contain these gauge theory pieces, but they contain these fermionic pieces. So the heuristic argument is very simple and looks like this. So imagine you have a topological insulator on a disk. The system has one boundary, and so you have edge states along the outer boundary. I'm going to partition my system into region A and region B. So if I cut these two systems apart like this, since this is a topological insulator, you always get these states. You get these gapless states in every boundary. Okay. So if I remove these two systems to get a piece from each other, you've got the boundary states in region B, the boundary states in region A. If I glue them back together, the edge states will cancel and end up being gapped again. But now if I trace out region B, I'm left with region A and its sort of boundary states. So what we're going to see in the entanglement spectrum is that we see in the entanglement something that looks like the edge theory of the topological insulator, but it has to do with the fact that these states exist on the cut where we split the systems. Okay. So for all the figures I'm going to show you, I'm using the following geometry. Okay. So I have a cylinder geometry like this, and I'm cutting right in the center, for example, into regions A and region B. And so I have some physical edge state, which is buried deep in this region here, and I have my cut state, which is going to lie on the cut. So I'm cutting this region here. I have the cut in region A, the cut in region B, which would cancel if I re-glued them. But in this case, I'm going to see some states which lie on this cut area. Okay. So the other important thing to notice is that I have translation variance in this direction around the circle. So I'm going to plot all of my figures as a function of the conserved quantum number in that direction. So you're going to see things that look like band structures. And that's because I'm plotting the entanglement spectra as a function of the conserved momentum along the y direction or along the circular direction. So let's first take a look at a trivial insulator. So this is the band structure of a trivial insulator on a cylinder. You see there's this is your valence band, your conduction band. There's a big gap in the states. So you imagine your chemical potential sits right in the gaps. There's no low energy excitations. There's no surface states. If you calculate the eigenvalues of the matrix C and plot them versus the conserved momentum, you see this structure here. This is a line of eigenvalues equal 0. It's a line of eigenvalues equal 1. All the states at 0 and 1 contribute nothing to the entanglement entropy. It's only the states that are deformed slightly away from 0 and 1 which contribute anything. And you can imagine that if you deform this insulator here, you could push all the states to 0 and 1, which is the statement that you can make entanglement entropy vanish. And if you look at the entanglement energies, which are the eigenvalues of this entanglement Hamiltonian, you see the following spectrum. Okay, so if you do this log transform of this exact spectrum, it pulls out a lot of the information near 0 and 1, which is exponentially close to 0 and 1, and you sort of see this spectrum, which has these sort of separate bands. Okay, this is right in the middle, and you see there's a gap right in the middle in this case. Okay, so this is the entanglement spectrum for a trivial insulator, like you'd see in some semiconductor. Yes? So C is this two-particle correlation function. Okay, so if I don't restrict the two-particle correlation function to lie in a certain region, it's a projection operator. So all its eigenvalues are 0 or 1. As soon as I truncate it, as long as my system's not diagonal in real space, all the some eigenvalues will be pushed away from 0 and 1. And so in this case, for the trivial insulator, most of the eigenvalues are still right near 0 and 1, except a few that are deformed away in this case.
So these eigenvalues of C for half the system?
Exactly, that's right, yeah, that's per half the system, right? And so if I do this 1 minus C, or C over 1 minus C transform with log, I get this spectrum. All it does is basically pulls the states away from 0 and 1 so I can see them more clearly than this log.
Okay.
So with a single body entanglement spectrum, we can ask, how do we calculate the full entanglement spectrum, the mini body entanglement spectrum, the eigenvalues of the reduced density operator, okay? So there's an easy way to get the mini body entanglement from something like filling single particle entanglement levels. Like you would get the mini body energy spectrum of a free fermion system by filling the energy levels, okay? So what you imagine is you start off in your system with n total particles. But when you cut it, you're allowed to have any number of particles in region A as long as you can hold it, right? So if your system has 50 particles and you can put 25 particles in region A, then when you cut it, you could have, for example, 0 particles in region A, or 1, or 2, or up to 25, for example, okay? So it turns out the reduced density matrix breaks up into particle sectors, and the particle sectors are the allowed number of particles in region A, okay? So the allowed number, so the reduced density matrix breaks up into conserved sort of decoupled blocks with 0 particles in region A, 1 particle in region A, all the way up to the number of maximum particles in region A, okay? So what we do is we pick a particle sector of the reduced density matrix we want to look at. So let's say we want to look at the sector with 10 particles in it. And then what you do is you fill up this band structure with 10 particles, right? And then you look at all excitations from that lowest energy ground state with 10 particles in it. And that gives you the mini body entanglement spectrum in the 10 particle sector. So basically the number of particle sector you're looking at tells you where the entanglement Fermi level lies. And so suppose we have, in this case, at half filling, so we fill this up with some half number of particles, then we can simply calculate the mini body entanglement spectrum by looking at all excitations away from this sort of filled entanglement ground state. And you can, it's hard to see here, but these are sort of the entanglement eigenvalues plotted as a function of mini body momentum. And you can see, because it's a trivial insulator, it's hard to see, but you see there's actually two non-degenerate states here. And so you actually get a splitting between the ground state and the lowest state. And so the ground state of this entanglement, in this case, is gapped and non-degenerate. Okay. Now let's move on to talk about the topological insulator case. This is the energy spectrum of the topological insulator solved on a cylinder. And so I've only plotted one edge state branch. Okay, if I plotted both edge state branches, they would be two branches here, one going the other way. Okay, so this is filled up to some Fermi level here, and so all the states are occupied up to some point. So that's my free fermion ground state. All right, so now I'm gonna cut the system. Okay, and what you find when you cut the system is instead of having all the eigenvalues clustered around 0 and 1, these are again the eigenvalues of the C matrix, you get a branch of states which travels, so this is periodic left to right, which travels from the bottom all the way up to the top branch, okay? So there's a branch of states which connects the eigenvalues at 0, which is sort of the bulk states, to the eigenvalues at 1, okay? And this mimics this one state which would be found on the cut, okay? So you only get one state, and the state, if you look at these wave functions, is localized right near where you cut the system. And so this looks very similar to the sort of edge state picture I showed you on the previous slide. So one question you may ask is, you know, I've cut on the cylinder, so I actually have a physical edge state over here. And you want to ask, does this physical edge state contribute to the entanglement at all? Is it, you know, interfering with anything or doing something interesting? And the answer is no, it doesn't. And the reason it doesn't is because this edge state is the state that's furthest localized in region A. It's exponentially bound to that edge. And so it actually has no weight, or exponentially low weight to lie in region B. So that edge state is completely unentangled with region B. And so the sort of entanglement eigenvalue that comes from the edge state being occupied will sit exactly at 1. It won't be in the center anywhere. So naively, we're going to go over some consequences later, but naively, this edge state doesn't contribute anything to the entanglement. The physical edge state doesn't contribute anything to the entanglement entropy. It's only the states near the cut. Okay. So it turns out that this edge state, cut state correspondence is very general. And the first really nice example of this was shown by Lee and Haldane in 2008. And they actually showed a very, very non-trivial case. They actually took a non-abelian fractional quantum Hall state, calculated its entanglement spectrum, and showed that the sort of spectrum of states you get in the entanglement spectrum matches that for the complicated gapless fermion or gapless conformal field theory you find on the edge. Okay, so we're going to show as an example, just to sort of drive home the point, how this works for this chiral fermion. So suppose I have, this is my chiral fermion edge state, for example, and I have it filled up to some level 0. And I want to ask, what are the mini body excitations above this ground state? Okay, so we can simply count the mini body excitations. The first thing is the state with no excitations, which is the ground state. There's one of those. And then, of course, I can excite a particle from 0 to 1. There's one state like that. Then I can excite particles from
minus 1 to 1, or from 2 to 0, which both have the same sort of energy. And so you can go on sort of counting what the numbers of excited states are. And so these started off in this order, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5. So these are the counting of the exact many-body eigenstates excited above this filled chiral fermion ground state. Okay. So an important point to notice is that at each level, all these states will be degenerates. You'll see degeneracies of rank 1, 1, 2, 3, and 5, as long as the spectrum is perfectly linear. If it's deformed away from linear at all, there will be some slight non-degeneracies or slight energy splittings. So if we calculate the many-body spectrum for the Chern insulator, this quantum Hall effect, you can sort of see how the counting works in this case. And in fact, the counting works up to the first 12 levels. Okay, this is the many-body spectrum. It counts up 1, 1, 2, 3, 5. And you can see there's some splittings here, which would go away in the thermodynamic limit. So this is some finite size system, and the counting works up to the first 12 levels and then breaks after that because of some finite size effects. Okay, so this shows that the sort of entanglement spectrum has this sort of edge state correspondence. And so this exhibits it for a more trivial case than what was previously shown for fractional quantum Hall, but still it's nice to see that the many-body spectrum does exactly match what you'd expect from some kind of cut state, which you're exciting with some entanglement excitations in this case. Okay. The other interesting thing to notice is that this many-body spectrum looks gapless in some way. It looks like you have a branch of states which keeps extending in this direction. And so this is very different than what we saw for the trivial insulator, which had a big gap to sort of the lowest energy state excitation states. Okay. So just as a final comparison, this is sort of just to sort of compare the two on the same slide. So this is an example of a entanglement energy, single particle entanglement energy for a trivial insulator. It's many-body spectrum. It's got a lowest energy many-body entanglement ground state with some splitting to the other branches. This case here is for the topological insulator. You can see it has this clear picture of spectral flow where these states, so this is periodic left to right. And so these states keep flowing up. This is attached to this left side here. It keeps going up. It's attached on this side and so on and so forth. And this leads to this sort of gapless branch structure in the entanglement spectrum. So the difference between the topological insulator and the trivial insulator is that in this case, this entanglement spectrum has some sort of spectral flow which connects the lowest energy states to the highest energy states as you go across the Brillouin zone. Whereas in this case, this left side connects over here. Here, this left side connects up one branch. Okay, so the spectral flow is an important property. Okay, so that's the sort of introduction to the fermionic entanglement I wanted to give you. And now I'm going to discuss a topological invariant or a way to derive a topological invariant from the entanglement spectrum and physically relate it back to the sort of Chern number you calculate for the normal quantum Hall systems. Okay, so the quantity we're going to begin looking at is the trace of this matrix as a function of the momentum. Okay, so this I'm going to show how this trace works for both the trivial insulator case and the topological insulator. So this is the energy spectrum. I calculate the single body entanglement spectrum this way, and we see the clear difference between the single body case and these two cases. And then I want to calculate the trace of this matrix as a function of Ky. Okay? So in the trivial case, the trace has some bump in it, but there's nothing strange going on. Okay? At Ky equals minus pi, the trace is at 40. At Ky equals plus pi, the trace is also at 40. But in the topological, instead, there's this jump, there's this discontinuity in the trace as you go from minus pi to pi. Okay? In fact, the jump is exactly by 1. It jumps from 40.5 to 39.5 at this point. Okay. So let's try to see if we can understand this trace and then subsequently use that to define some kind of topological invariant. Okay, so we can clearly see this trace tells you which state of matter is which. There's no discontinuity here. There's discontinuity here by an amount of 1. So this trace distinguishes these two states. So now I want to ask, can we relate this to other quantities that distinguish these states? And we'll see there's an exact mapping, which is in a moment. Okay. So this trace actually is very simple. So the trace is the expectation value of this two-particle correlation function it's the trace of this two-particle correlation function where you put the same position index on each of these guys here. This ends up being the expectation value of the number of particles in region A as a function of Ky. Okay? So at each Ky, you look at the number of particles expected to be in region A, and that tells you that's what this trace is as a function of Ky. All right? So this is a picture of the energy spectrum, and I've sort of collapsed my lower band into this sort of schematic band here, and I've collapsed my upper band into the schematic band there. This is filled up to some Fermi level here, so all the edge branches are filled up to this point. Okay? Now, if we compare this to entanglement spectrum, we see something interesting happens as we go through this point. Okay, so we're looking exactly here where at the k's where these edge states are looking at the entanglement spectrum. So we see that the bulk states are uniform. So at each point, each ky, the same number of bulk states are filled. Okay, so the bulk states basically exist halfway in region A and region B, so they don't change the entanglement spectrum. So what changes is actually the physical edge state, because what happens here is that the occupied states here lie on the red edge. Okay, as soon as you get to this k, the occupied states lie on the blue edge. Okay, so it means that the ground states, the sort of number of states in region A, which is on the red edge side, is changing as you go across this k, right? As you go across the k, which state is occupied on which edge changes. It goes from being a state in region A being occupied on the red side to a state in region B being occupied as soon as you switch ky. Okay, so what you would see in the entanglement spectrum is that you're not supposed to look at the green, you're supposed to look at the states which are occupied, which are these 0 and 1 states. So as you come across this point here, what happens is that you get one more state. So here, this is the physical edge state, and this is the state occupied. It's occupied near 1, because it's occupied and localized in region A. As you go across this k value, the state that's occupied is in region B, so it contributes a 0 to the entanglement spectrum, so it's on the other side. So as soon as you cross this point, one eigenvalue in the entanglement spectrum jumps from 0 to 1. And it happens because you have a state which is occupied, which is on the complete opposite side of the system in this case. Right? And so this sort of simply leads to this trace index jump, at least to this discontinuity. So actually the physical edge state is what leads to this discontinuity. It's the physical edge state which is being occupied on one side versus the other side, which is changing at that k value. So it's a clear signature of this topological nature. Okay. So to define a topological invariant, we're going to take this quantity, which is sort of this difference in traces here. Okay. And this reduces to the so what I'm doing is I'm defining a quantity A phi, which is the difference in the trace of my ground state after I've threaded one flux quantum, subtracting the trace when I have zero flux quanta. So I imagine I have two different ground states, one with no flux quanta in the cylinder and one with one flux quantum. And I'm looking at the difference in these two traces, which gives me the difference in the number of particles in region A before and after I thread this flux. And we remember from the first half of the talk that when I thread flux, what's happening is you generate some current across the system. Okay. So as you thread flux, this gives me some electric field in this case. Electric field is proportional to the time derivative of the flux changing. And this derives some current because you have a Hall conductivity in the system, right? And the current is just equal to the amount of particles leaving region A, right? And so what you can do is you relate the amount of particles leaving region A to the time derivative of this trace of the C operator. And as a function, if you integrate the left and right sides over time, what you find is that the difference in these two quantities here is exactly the number of charges transferred from one side to the other side, which is the Chern number. And so what we can do is we can relate this trace of the entanglement matrix back to the topological invariant in the Chern number. And so this is sort of a generalization of some work that was done by Vitkowski, Jackson, and Klisch at the beginning of this year. So the what we learn from this is that we can learn about what the nature of the system is from just the entanglement spectra. So if I take a trace of my entanglement spectra, I can calculate this topological invariant. Right? It's very different than the standard way to calculate topological invariants, which you get by doing some integrals over the Brillouin zone or doing some twisted boundary conditions in many ways. So instead of calculating some integral, you simply calculate a trace of some operator, and that gives you the Chern number in this case. Right? So one way this can be utilized is just, for example, calculate this topological invariant when you have disorder. So if you have a disordered system, you put random potential on each side of your topological insulator, you can calculate this topological invariant as a function of disorder strength, and you see it clearly has a transition from being 1, Chern number equal 1, Chern number equals 0 as you crank up the disorder. This is sort of looking at a transition, a localization transition in the quantum anomalous Hall effect state. And so this gives you some numerical advantage because you don't have to calculate a numerical integration over some boundary conditions. And in fact, you only have to twist boundary conditions in one direction, not two directions. So it gives you some advantage to numerical advantage to calculating this this quantity. The hope is that this quantity could be generalized to many body systems, and in that case, you could hope that this would help you really speed up numerical calculations if you were looking at disorder systems, for example. Although that's not even close to being proven or anything. So we can show actually this doesn't just work for the quantum Hall effect, it actually works for the quantum spin Hall effect too. So this is the energy spectrum for the quantum spin Hall effect. These are the states on a single edge, so now you get states going in both directions, and it's time reversal symmetry that protects that gapless degeneracy point. Okay. And we can define a Z2 trace index. So for example, in this case, we find that this is the trivial insulator, which is time reversal invariant. This is the topological insulator, and this is the edge states on a single edge, okay? And I'm putting my Fermi level here, which crosses the edge states at two separate K values. You can calculate the single particle entanglement spectra, the eigenvalues of C, and you see in this case, of course, you get two branches, because exactly like we talked about earlier, it mimics the edge states. And once you calculate the trace index, you see something a little bit different, okay? So the trace index for the trivial insulator is completely flat. You see no features at all. And the trace index for the topological insulator actually has two jumps. So it goes from here, it jumps by one from 20 to 19, and then you go a little bit more in K and it jumps up back to one, okay? So in fact, this distance here in K space is exactly the distance between these edge states. So the reason this happens in this case is because since you have time reversal symmetry, the Chern number actually vanishes. So there can't be any real trace of this entanglement spectra. So the trace over the entire K space will vanish because it goes from being, you know, here, it jumps down one, goes up one, so those cancel and it goes back to being here, right? So if you look at the process of threading a full flux quantum in the system, you see the trace index doesn't change because the number of particles in region A doesn't change because there's no Chern number. But if you only calculate the change in the particles in region A when you thread half a flux, so from 0 to pi, this actually defines some kind of topological invariant. And this is sort of related to the ideas that Fu and Kane had about Z2 pumping when you thread a pi flux. So for this time reversal invariant cases, the sort of experiment you're supposed to imagine is that instead of threading a full flux quantum in the system to transfer charge, you thread only a pi flux, and this gives you some kind of Z2 transfer. And the reason this happens is because in this case the Chern number vanishes, and so you have to find some other way to calculate the topological invariant. Okay, but anyways, the point is that in 2D you can from just the entanglement spectrum alone, you can calculate what the topological invariants are for the Z2 case or for the integer case. And essentially all this is doing is it's a clever way to sort of count the edge states or a clever way to figure out what the electromagnetic response is in the system. Okay. So let's go over sort of one more interesting phenomenon that I'm only going to sort of briefly motivate. I'm not going to spend much time talking about this since my time's almost up. So I want to ask a question. So I want to ask, we know that protected physical edge states in the energy spectrum imply you get these states on the cut, okay? So if you have a topological insulator and you cut it to partition it for entanglement, you see that the entanglement eigenvalues have this edge state-like structure. So we know that physical edge states give rise to entanglement cut states, okay? But the question you can ask is, if there are no protected edge states, so if my system is like this, so that my edge states are gapped, can you still see protected states in the entanglement? Okay. So for example, let's take the quantum spin hall effect and apply some magnetic field to break time reversal symmetry. As soon as you break time reversal symmetry, you destroy the state of matter. And this sort of initial crossing is no longer protected. And what you see is you get a gap opening up in the edge state spectrum. So now what you can do is you can have a Fermi level which lies in this gap, and so you don't see any type of edge states. And so this sort of makes this a trivial state of matter. Right? So now you can ask, what happens if I calculate the entanglement for the system? Let me put the chemical potential right in the gap. There's no edge states. This is my ground state, all is filled states. And let me ask, what does the entanglement spectrum look like? So if you calculate the entanglement spectrum, what you find is that it looks completely gapless still. So this is a picture of the entanglement spectrum for this Hamiltonian, okay, or that ground state. So it's a little bit confusing because it's not clear why this sort of protected state would exist here when there's no edge states here, right? There's nothing happening in this way. In fact, we know, for example, if I calculate the trace index, since my Fermi level is not intersecting any edge states, the trace index is going to be trivial, okay? So this is sort of a puzzle. Why is it still gapless, right? And so this is what we set out to resolve last year, or I guess this year, with Emil Prodan at Yeshiva and Andrei Brnovig. So we looked at these cases. So we looked at, for example, the trivial insulator, the time reversal invariant quantum spin-all effect, and the time reversal broken quantum spin-all effect. And you see from by eye, you can clearly see the difference between these two, but by eye, these two look the same. So it looks like there's no difference between these two spectra. And the answer is that there actually is something that's quite different. It's just you can't see it by eye from this picture, okay? So here we see you get these gaps, right? Again, there's no spectral flow from bottom to top. This is the quantum spin-all effect. These states are connected from the lowest energy to the highest energy by spectral flow. For the time reversal broken case, I mean, it may be hard to see, but what you find is that for time reversal broken case, you still have this protected crossing here, but all the other crossings at these points get lifted. And so you actually break the spectral flow in the system. So instead of having the sort of spectral flow flowing from bottom to top, you sort of open gaps from the bottom region to the top. So what that means is that this branch of states here is actually physically separated from all the rest of the system. So what that means is you get some surface state or some cut states which are protected, but they don't have this nice spectral flow property. So all the properties that this trace index are based on go away. So you can't actually have, so what I'm saying is that basically there's some kind of protected states here, but they're not the same type of topological protected states. So the reason the states are protected in this case is because you actually have an inversion symmetry. So every degeneracy at minus pi and pi is lifted. The only degeneracy that stays is this one at k equals zero. And it turns out that's there because it's protected by an inversion symmetry. So if you break inversion symmetry in this Hamiltonian, it actually will open that degeneracy as well. And so it turns out there are actually many interesting cases where you have point group symmetries or other discrete symmetries which protect entanglement modes but don't protect the real edge state modes. So you can have many different other symmetries which give you protected entanglement states, which means they cannot be deformed to have vanishing entanglement entropy, but which give you sort of trivial real physical edge states. Okay. So, So as a summary for the talk, the entanglement spectrum of these topological insulators has revealed some interesting features. It's hoped that, the big hope is that entanglement will, at the very least, teach us something new about physics we didn't understand. The real hope is that maybe it can actually lead to more efficient numerical techniques for diagonalizing systems or for studying many-body systems or for finding any type of many-body information. So it's not much more efficient to do this for free systems, but for interacting systems or strongly correlated systems, it could be that entanglement gives you a much more efficient way to do things numerically. So some open questions that people are looking at now still are, what are the properties of entanglement in disordered fermionic systems? Can you define similar topological invariants in other dimensions, which is almost certainly true, although the details haven't worked out. And there's other ways, the other two points are looking at these protected entanglement modes, which can exist because of discrete point group symmetries or other type of discrete symmetries. And of course, there's always the hope that you can find some different kind of magical cut in the system, which lets you find some other interesting information. So I cut all my systems in real space. You can cut it any way you want in any Hilbert space, especially for interacting systems, you can get something non-trivial. But finding new ways to cut the system to learn something new besides what you learn in sort of real space entanglement may lead to some interesting developments. So thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
So your last result, does it mean that if you break time reversal but not inversion, it's still distinct from ordinary insulator?
Absolutely, yeah. So it means that, so what it means is that, for example, let's imagine that, let's look at this picture. So you could deform this picture so that this band of states flattens out to be zero, but you can't ever remove that state. So point is you can never deform this inversion symmetric topological insulator to have vanishing entanglement entropy. But the reason you can distinguish it from a trivial insulator is very simple. So a trivial insulator is an insulator which can be adiabatically connected to the atomic limit, which means that it can turn off all the hoppings and the system goes back to its atomic limit without any gaps closing. Okay. So in this inversion case, even though I break Hamiltonian symmetry, my bulk band structure still has been inverted with respect to the normal system. So I have this inversion eigenvalue. So in order to go back to the atomic system, these eigenvalues have to reinvert so I get my standard atomic orbitals back. And so these systems here with inversion symmetry are also distinct from trivial insulators. And some of these inversion symmetric topological insulators have interesting response properties like different electromagnetic behavior, and some of them have trivial response properties. So some are interesting and some are not so interesting. Yes?
Do you study what happens at the phase transition? Because if you have this topological insulator, you have this M, right? You can change and go from trivial to non-trivial.
Right.
Just at the phase transition, how does this...
Right, so at the phase transition, what happens is that your states become less and less localized, right? So what you're imagining is that I have my states in the cut, well, my system's gapped, okay? So in principle, my states are localized in some way, okay? Now, if you cut the system, the states that are contributing to the entanglement entropy are the ones near the cut. And if you start lowering the gap, the ones near the cut become more and more, right? Because the states that extend near the cut, you know, the correlation length is getting longer and longer, right? So what will happen is basically a state in the bulk, okay, which initially was gapped, will now contribute the cut area and actually will kill the state. So you actually get some states which come from 0 and 1, which penetrate in as well. And so what happens is that you'll get a gap that closes there, which is a bulk gap, and that will destroy the sort of edge state spectrum. So the point is that as you deform, so this is the trivial side. So let me go from the trivial side to the topological side. As you start tuning the mass to 0, these states will start penetrating more and more into the bulk. And eventually you'll see a phase transition, a gap will close at 1/2 or something in this case. So the entanglement spectrum kind of mimics what you see in the energy spectrum.
So these were lattice models,
yes,
for three fermions?
Right.
How large were these? This was a cylinder, right?
That's right, yeah.
And how large was that?
I think we used like hundreds of sites.
Okay, so we don't see discretization in KY because it's...
It's large as you want to make it. I mean, it's free fermion system since we're dealing with single particle, we're calculating this a single particle way.
If you didn't have free fermions and
yes,
you had to use some numerical method,
yes,
for that, presumably you would get to, you're still in the,
yep,
you would be able to put maybe 10 sites there.
Yeah.
How would that affect, what happens if you try to apply these techniques to interacting systems?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So the so largely the answers are completely unknown. So the so we know the bulk boundary correspondence for interacting systems works well. People have heuristic proofs. So the qualitative pictures of some of the physics works out the same. This topological variator defined today, whether that there is a mini-byte generalization of that, and how easy it is to calculate when you have a discrete system. You can't just look at continuous integrals.
Right. So would you be killed by noise or finite size effects?
If the system is large enough to support a topological state, which means the exponential decay of the
sure,
surface states are big enough, then probably you can look at something similar. But I don't know. I mean, I would say this stuff right now is at the stage of trying to find interesting stuff at the single particle level that may be adapted to the mini particle, but I think nothing's been shown.
When you computed the trace,
yes,
and you got a gap of,
yep,
exactly one, was,
yep,
that, would you got exactly one or up to some?
In that case, the difference between 0 and 1 is how much probability of the edge state lies. It's exponentially close to 0 and 1.
Exponentially close.
Yeah, because it tells you how much of the edge state lies in region A to region B. And so as long as the edge state is exponentially localized, then it's close to 0 and 1. So it's for that trace index, it has to exactly do with the property of how much the physical edge state lies in region A or B, that's exponentially localized.
But since this is a gap system, maybe a small system would be enough to...
That's right, small, yeah, yeah. So you could probably see like 0.8, 0.9 pretty easily in a gap system.
Questions?
Yeah, so I have a question. So what is the relationship between the trace of the entanglement spectrum and the phenomenon entropy?
I don't know of a direct relation. It seems like, there's, it's sort of
there's the torso of the phenomenon entropy as one of those jumps.
No, but the problem is the jump is between 0 and 1. So the phenomenon entropy doesn't get contributions from eigenvalues at 0 and 1. So the phenomenon doesn't see the fact that the 0 and 1 is exchanging.
Yeah. I see.
In terms of the eigenvalues of C, the binomial entropy is 1 minus lambda log 1 minus lambda.
All right.
Minus with a so minus lambda log lambda. And so if an eigenvalue switches between 0 and 1, it still doesn't change the binomial entropy.
Okay.
The other way it doesn't enter the binomial entropy is that this trace quantity is actually related to something physical, like a charge. And so it's unlikely you get a direct relation between something like a charge and the binomial entropy.
So, Mr. Can you calculate, if you had the entire entanglement spectrum, can you calculate the trace index?
So what you would do if you have the many body case. What you could easily do is you would look at the and let's assume we're not in a supermatrix, so particles are conserved. So you're looking at some whatever fermion system with interactions, for example. So what you do is you calculate the reduced density matrix in the, say, 10-particle sector, right? And you get some huge set of eigenvalues, right? And then you look at the ground state when you thread one flux quantum. Okay? What will happen is that you're transferring one particle from region A to region B. So your mini-body entanglement spectrum is shifting a particle sector. So what you do is you would compare, you would take the ground state with the flux inserted and calculate a different particle sector, like in A plus, in 10 plus 1, and see if these match. And if they match, you know those are trend numbers. Basically, this trace index tells you that the mini particle sectors translate as you thread flux, basically, from one to the other. And so if you can't separate particle sectors from each other, then it's just a mess. I don't think you can do it in the case.
One question?
Okay, let's thank everyone.